Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hello, everyone. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. In Nashville, I'd just like to thank the library first for having me and Parnassus Books. Ann Patchett is one of my literary heroines, so it's a true honor to be here, and thank you all for coming. Tonight, I thought I would just talk a little bit about my journey as a writer, how I got to this point, and then a bit about the one and only and my inspiration for that, and then I would love to spend time with your questions and hear what you would like to talk about. I know the movies are always the top of that list, so I'll save that for the end. I've always wanted to be a writer since the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I said that I wanted to be an author, and I wrote little stories and poems my whole life, and got a couple of honorable mentions in Cricket Magazine, but was unpublished until I was the editor of my high school newspaper. And writing was always so important to me. Libraries are important to me. My mother's a retired librarian, and we spent our summers going to the library and checking out books. But somehow I got derailed and went to law school. So I fell into that trap. Are there any lawyers out there? It's like you take the LSAT because you just aren't really sure what else to do, so you just take the LSAT because you know you can, you know, study for that, do well. And I'm going to take these bangles off. That's always a rookie move when there's a mic involved. Take these off. Okay, here's my water. All right, so I went to law school, and I don't regret going to law school per se, but my very first job at my huge Manhattan law firm, learning how to work the phones and the computers, and I knew I had made a terrible mistake. So I was $100,000 in debt at that point, and oh, Rob Ariola from my law firm. What's going on, Rob? I keep looking over there, and I'm like, he looks so familiar. Rob, tell them how it was at Winston and Strawn. Really? Oh, the recruiting lunch was really good, wasn't it? We fooled you, Rob. We're like, it's awesome here. But no, there were some good moments for sure. See, now I'm backpedaling. Like, it was great. But no, I mean, I knew for me that it wasn't no career for me, but I had to pay back those loans, and while I billed General Electric, you want to hear something scary? 80020 matter one. And I haven't been there in 13 years. I know the client and the matter number. But I billed GE while I wrote my first novel, and that's not completely true, but a little bit I did. And so I got an agent at the end of the process. It took me about 5 years to write that book. I got an agent. I was very excited. And then the rejection letters started to roll in. It was a depressing time. It was right around 9/11. I decided that I was going to quit my job and move to London and try again. If I had been brave enough, I would have gone to Italy. But I would have written Eat, Pray, Love. Don't you love that book? But instead, I moved to London, and I wrote Something Borrowed. So I gave myself this self-imposed one-year deadline, and it took me a little longer. About 14 months later, I'd finished the book, and I sent it to new agents. My first agent, for the writers out, how many of you are writers out there writing? I know there's more of you. I know some people don't like to raise their hand if they're not published, but you're still a writer even if you aren't published, so raise your hand. But my first agent, after I sent I was waiting to hear back from all the publishing houses, and I couldn't get an answer, and I finally said, like, Jody, her name is Jody Rhodes, don't send your manuscripts to her, she's evil. But she, you know, years passed, I was like, I really shouldn't say, I redacted her name on my website, it's Jody Rhodes. She's in San Francisco. She's very mean-spirited. So she finally wrote back. My sister's greatest hobby is like, do you think Jody knows how successful you are? I'm like, I don't think she cares or knows. I think she signed up so many clients. But Anyway, she wrote back I kept saying, you know, can I get the status of my submissions? Can I please get the status of my submission? You know, just let me know. I realize that this isn't good news, but I would really like to have closure. Could we? And she finally just wrote, they all rejected it. And she did put a period at the end of the sentence, which I thought was so insulting. So anyway, I got another experience with the second agent, and she was wonderful and sent the book out, and we had two book offers right away, and it was very, I say, and I've said this in front of my children, this is the happiest day of my life. But the reason that I say that is because, and my husband too, you know, he doesn't like that one so much, but when you get married, it's so much about the, you know, you have to have, it's a party that you have to have perfect, so there's pressure with that. And we have children, there's a lot of pain. So this was like the pure joy with no pressure. This call came in, it was a dream realized. And it was wonderful. And then I started writing Something Blue. That was a panic moment, though, with the second novel, because you realize for so many years, your goal is publication. You just want to get published. And then once you know that it's going to be published and you're writing your second book, you realize that people are going to read it and the reviewers are going, you know, you're writing for an audience and under a deadline, it becomes a very different experience. Stephen King's new book just came out. I love him. I don't like horror, but I like him. If that makes sense. I love when he doesn't write horror, but in his memoir, he says you have to write on writing. Have you all read that? That's like amazing. But he says you have to write with the door closed. You looked at him. He's read it. He loves it. What's that? It's so good. Yeah. Whether or not you like Stephen King or whether you want to be a writer or whatever, I highly recommend it. But he says you have to write with the door closed, which is very true. It was very true when I was writing The One and Only, and the sex scenes in The One and Only. My dad got an advance copy, and he sent me a neat text. It was like, I'll pretend your editor wrote page 118. I was like, Dad, close your eyes, relax. My dad's very literal about my books. He's before the movie came out for Something Borrowed. Rob, I'm so touched that you came. Thank you. But before the book came out, so we're sitting there having breakfast, we're eating cereal, and he turns to me and he's like, the couple in your book, Rachel and the fella, I'm like, Dex. And he's like, yeah, I really hope they're happy. I was like, Dad, they're not living in the basement with Monica and Chandler. It's done. It's a wrap. But yeah, he's pretty literal with these books. But anyway, where was I? So yeah, Something Blue was harder to write because you realize that you're writing for an audience. So you have to write with the door closed, and you have to really be true to your characters. And sometimes that can be hard because you know at various points what you think you want the reader wants. It happened again with Baby Proof. I think people who were reading which was the worst named title. Like, that was the terrible title. If I could redo one thing, it's just not bad in the field of regrets to have with my career, I would Baby Proof. Like, don't you think that book's about babies? Of course you do. It's called Baby Proof. It's not about babies. It's more about like soulmates. Like, you know, is your soulmate someone who wants the same thing that you want on paper, or is it someone that you would do anything for despite not wanting the same things on paper? So I don't know what that should be called, but it shouldn't have been called Baby Proof. But the third book, I knew that people wanted my audience, small though it was at the time, I knew that they wanted a third book, a continuation. So one of my favorite things to do when I write fiction is the creating the world and the characters. So I knew I didn't want to keep with those, you know, I didn't want to write a series. I never intended to write a series or even the sequel. So that was tough. But in general, I think as a writer, you have to be true to your characters and not necessarily what you want them to do, but sort of who you've created and the world that they're in, and sort of really get in their heads. And that's why, well, I'll get into that in a second. I'm a little scattered, but let me go back to The One and Only first before I get into the process of writing. So I wrote several books after that, all about relationships, you know, Love the One You're With, Heart of the Matter, Where We Belong. They're all relationship-driven books, and it's what I like to explore. I think that relationships are, you know, we are passions and the work we do, of course, but I think at core we are sisters and mothers and best friends, and I think that's really what makes us who we are. And so that's what I love to write about. and have written about, and this is definitely what The One and Only is about. But my first inspiration for The One and Only, the first sort of kernel and the thread, because typically I start with a premise and then the characters come from there, but was this idea of unconventional love. And I think that so often in life we expect our relationships to look a certain way. We expect our lives to be a certain way, but so often we might want something that's not right on paper. You fall in love with the one person you shouldn't. And that's what I wanted to explore with The One and Only. But this the sports backdrop was brand new. And has anyone read the book yet? Oh, that's nice. Rob, why isn't your hand up? You were waiting for tonight, weren't you? That's nice. That's good. So, but the sports backdrop, I'm very passionate about sports, college sports in particular. Since I was a little girl, I followed ACC basketball and was very into it. Wrote to the college, wrote to coaches in the ACC asking for the job as manager, got answers from them, and then applied to Wake Forest once I knew I had a lock on that position. And I knew it was the perfect job because it was that we were the basement of the ACC at the time, but I knew we were going to be good because we had recruited three McDonald's All-Americans. So I knew we were going to be good. And I did overlap with Tim Duncan. So that's my last vestige of youth, that someone that I handed towels and water to is still relevant in the playoffs. Do you think they're going to win? Are there any Spurs fans here? Yes. Is there any Heat fan here? Yeah, you read On Writing. Did you read the Stephen King book she recommended yet?
Yeah, she read it. I was the one outside the door while she...
But okay, right. So she was writing with the door closed, and she referred to Stephen King and said, this is why you need to stay on that side of the door. Got it. Have you read any of my books yet?
No.
You're going to, though. You're going to read this one, aren't you? Yes. But you're going to read this one. Okay. Have any men out there read my books besides Rob? Okay. You guys? Oh, awesome. That's good. David Erdack, have you read my books? Okay. Okay, Paige. That's not acceptable. But so sports, very important to me. And when I said I wanted to, you know, write a book with sports as a backdrop, my editor was, you know, concerned, as editors you should be, with the you know, book sales and the marketing side. And she said, do you think that will alienate your core, you know, audience of women? And I answered her very quickly and frankly, and I said, I don't think so. I think women love their sports just like men do. I think we have our teams and we're passionate about them. But that said, you know, even if they aren't, I mean, I love all the Rocky movies. They're among my favorite, and I don't watch boxing. So I thought, you know, this book will still be very much about relationships. And I switched it to football because I think that football has a broader appeal, particularly when you put it in Texas and it has all the color. And it was just this incredibly rich backdrop to be able to use, that I could use to explore these themes in The One and Only, such as loyalty. Commitment to something bigger than yourself. I love the way sports brings people from very diverse backgrounds together, and they're all sort of, they have this common goal. So all of these things, I think, worked very well for The One and Only. I did have a few. Are there any, like, really big sports, college sports fans here? Okay. So Jim Boeheim blurbed this book, and so did Coach Pat Dye and Ralph Sampson. So I had three Hall of Famers reading it, and it was very funny because I sent them all. I sent it to them for very particular things in mind. You know, Coach Dye, read it for the football. You know, Ralph Sampson's just a good friend and good catch-all. But Coach Boeheim, the NCAA investigation angle and what it's like to run a major program in a small town. And I'm, like, looking at you because I want you to read my book. Okay, you promised me I can move on to someone. No, I'm just kidding. But so I gave it to them to read, and they read it, and they got back to me. And instantly, out of the gate, Coach Boeheim was talking about, you know, he said, oh, yeah, you got the NCAA thing right. It's good that you made the one issue with Ryan happen 15 years before. It's not a spoiler, don't worry. But, you know, he explained that. He said, the superstitions you nailed. He's like, you know, you got the shades of gray with the, you know, how hard it is to run a big program. And he's like, but let's talk about Lucy and Shay. And then, so they're the female, for the people who have read it, they're the friendship and the core friendship in the book. And he was talking about, oh, I don't think it's unfair. What, again, I'm being careful not to give spoilers here, but he was scrutinizing their friendship, the history of it. It's like, in the next draft, I think you really need to show this. And Coach Dye did the same thing. I mean, these are 70-year-old, you know, iconic coaches. And I have Coach Dye saying, well, you know, I understood, Ryan. You know, first he opened the conversation with, I want to know how a Yankee from Chicago knows so much about college football. And I was like, yes. But then he started, you know, I understood. I have to be very careful around this, what he said. But he said, I understood Ryan. I had a daddy like Ryan. I get Ryan. He said, I understood Lucy. He said, Lucy was hurt. Her feelings were hurt. He's like, I hurt my own kids' feelings all the time. And he instantly delved into the relationships. So I think it shows that, you know, and I'm no longer trying to sell you men on reading the book, but I'm trying to say that, you know, what I write about is, I think, has very universal appeal, and it's very relatable because these relationships, this is what our life is. It's what our lives are all about, and that's what I love to tell, to analyze when I write these stories. And the other thing I like to do is to take, you know, basically good people, because I think we're all, you know, good people. We're all trying to do the right thing, for the most part. And we don't want to hurt others. We certainly don't want to hurt those closest to us. And yet, inevitably in life, that's what happens. We see it time and time again. And it's, you know, we have these, you know, if it's not a complete falling out with our friendship, with a friend, there's massive hurt feelings, there's analysis, there's, you know, you did this, or I felt this way, or maybe it's never spoken. And between spouses, you see this. And I think so much of life is about, you know, trying to find empathy for one another and trying to find forgiveness and trying to do the right thing and get back on the path and really understand one another. And I think if I had to say, I was just asked recently, and I never really thought about the question until it was posed to me, but, you know, what are you trying to do as a writer? I firmly maintain that I don't write with a message in mind. I don't even write with a theme in mind. I write a story with the premise and characters, and the characters form relationships, and the relationships drive the plot in a very organic way. So I don't set out to say, okay, I'm going to teach this lesson. But the one thing I do consciously do is put these characters in unsympathetic situations and examine the shades of gray and the messiness of our relationships and the complicated nature of our relationships, and then hope that you, as the reader, root for them in spite of what they're doing. And if you don't agree with it, you still understand it. And you know, it's something that I do, I think, consciously as a writer and as a mother. You know, my children, I constantly ask the question, how do you think that made him feel or her feel? Make a lot of mistakes as a mother, but I think that part I do write, and it's so important to me. And I always let them decide if they're going to birthday parties, and they summarily dismissed a birthday party recently, and I said, what if no one goes to that party? And I got one of the two to be like, I'll go. So, I mean, that's kind of what I do in my fiction. And I think I pushed it a little bit with this one, although you can't really push it much more than the first one. You know, a girl falls, you know, has an affair with her best friend's fiance. I mean, that's pretty taboo in the scheme of things. And I still get asked all these years in if that happened. Rob, did it happen? No. Rob, okay. Didn't happen. So my books aren't autobiographical, but I do draw on the richness of the relationships around me. And, you know, even if I'm, you write about, you sort of, you draw on your relationships, but how often do you talk to a friend and you hear about what's going on in the lives of those people? And so I draw on all of that when I write. And I think that you'll find that I explore relationships and the one and only like all the ones before it. So that's all I have for my presentation today, but I would love to have to hear your questions and discuss what you want to discuss. Oh, the lights are on. Good. This library is awesome. It really is. I love it. Okay. Questions? Did you wear teal on purpose? To the few of you in teal? You know you did. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Well,
there's a lot of London in Something Blue, for sure. I think that, you know, I wanted, you know, I mentioned that none of my books is autobiographical, but when you write in the first person, so now I've written 7 books, and Heart of the Matter was written from 2 viewpoints, even though only one was in the first person, Valerie's was the third, but let's consider that 8 protagonists. I feel the need as a writer to have something major in common, you know, something significant in common with all of my main characters. And so for Darcy, it was a bit harder, especially at the outset of the book. By the end, I feel like I could relate to her, but in the beginning, I really didn't care for her, and it was very hard to write that book at first because every time she opened her mouth, I was just like, shut up. So we had London in common. And really the reason that I wrote that sequel in the first place was because when I was revising Something Borrowed, I was very conscious of I didn't want to fall into the genre of the exaggerated, you know, the good and the bad. I wanted to capture those shades of gray. And so in revising it in the final drafts, I added that sleepover scene, you know, when they're spending the night, and a few other scenes where I wanted to show that Darcy had, you know, a good side. And in so doing, I became more interested in her as a person. And so the idea sort of sprung from the revisions of Something Borrowed. But London was something that I had in common with Darcy, exploring London. And then right when I was writing, as I was writing Something Borrowed, I found out that I was pregnant with twins. I knew I was having one. I was very happy about that. We went to regular ultrasounds, and then I went to this ultrasound alone, and then that was the one where I found out there was 2 in there, and I was not, you know, thrilled with the news. So I am now. It's a wonderful thing, but at the time I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And so I went home and wrote that scene. I'm like, she's going to be pregnant with twins too. Bed rest. So that was, yeah, that's how that kind of came about. That's a good question, though. Sure.
Now that you have, you know, I know the first one took about 14 months, you said, but now that you've gotten to the point where you know what you're doing, you have your agent, you have your publisher, is it still, that
thing,
or is it longer?
No, it's so miserably long. I mean, it's just, you know, I keep expecting it to be, there are great moments of joy, and I love what I do, and that's the truth. But it's also, it's like, you know how it is. When I write a thank you note, I could write 3 drafts. Sympathy notes kill me. You know, it's just like, oh, so to write a book is agony, is truly agony. And I offer that, again, to be hopeful to the writers out there, because I don't think it ever gets easier. I mean, there are certain books that flow a bit more than others, and this one did flow. My best friend from high school remarked to me that this character reminded him more of me than any other. And I said, well, she's 33 and doesn't have children, and she's, you know, I have this, you know, established career. And he said, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just her voice. And when he said that, I recognized that that was true. And so it flowed a bit more, but it doesn't get any easier. And if anything, I think it gets a bit scarier. And that's because one of the things that drives me as a writer, more than, you know, more than sales or, you know, the times, is the feeling of never wanting it's not even so much as wanting to please the reader, is never wanting to disappoint my readers, and never wanting that. I mean, how many times have we said, oh, I liked his old stuff, you know, when it comes to a band, or I don't really like her anymore. And I used to like her, but it's just that, like, fills me with such fear, and I don't want to disappoint. And so it's, you know, to keep telling a book that I feel is at least as good as the one before it, add layers and grow as a writer, I think is a difficult thing, but it's so important to me. And that's one of the reasons that I went to a book every other year, because I didn't feel that I could keep up that pace of a book a year. You know, because when you write your first book, of course, it could take years leading up to it, and then you have longer, I won't bore you with all that, but yeah, that's my answer. Yeah, that's a good question. Yes.
So, not about any of the books, but just your thoughts in general. When you think about ideas for the books, do you instantly write them down? How do you?
Are you a writer?
Not really. Yeah. I'm just interested.
Yes.
You know, because I can't imagine how many ideas that you
sure
have.
Well, It's more threads of ideas. It's more, editor, I'm sure she wouldn't mind me telling you this. She has two daughters, and she was, got two, sperm donors. So they have two different fathers, and she's raised them alone. I think that's fascinating. I think the idea of, okay, it's not happening, I'm not meeting anyone, I'm 40, I want to be a mother. I think that's a fascinating, thread. So is that a plot for a book? No. In this book, this is the first time that the actual premise is sort of a spoiler, so I can't throw it out there, but love the one you're with. Running into the one who got away and then having a second chance. That's a universal, I think, idea. It's not a plot. It's not an outlined plot, but it's sort of an idea that's intriguing. What would you do if the person came back and, wanted you, but you weren't available and you had this chance to sort of go back to that fork in the road? Everyone's nodding on that one. You guys be careful when you're nodding next to the guy you're with. I did that when I was writing Love the One You're With. I Google and, I was the best goober cyber stalker before it became, in vogue. Before Facebook, I could find anyone. It's all about the quotation marks around the full name. But I called the Williams-Sonoma gift registry and just tried to ferret out what my ex, what they had registered for, where they were living. And I made a few probing calls to Williams-Sonoma. My husband came around the corridor and he's like, "Tell me you're not doing what I think you're doing." Pregnant with my two children. I was like, "I am, and I can also tell you what Amy's doing. Here's a complete profile." It's more. Oh, that was your question. It's more these premises that I'll save up and I think are intriguing, or Baby Proof again. That's another great example. Jennifer Aniston, Brad Pitt. This is the only tabloid-inspired book of mine. They're split, and how everyone said at first it was because Jennifer didn't want children, and it turned out to be a plant in the media from Angelina Jolie, of course. But backtracking on that a bit. Everyone turned on her immediately. It was as if it was like, oh, well, she didn't want children. So, of course, Brad is going to leave her. Poor Brad. And I thought that was so fascinating that I think society allows you to be a stay-at-home mother, a working mother, and, any kind of mother you want to be. But if you just don't want to have a child, I think it's sort of the last taboo against women. And so that was something that I explored that came really straight from us, pages of Us Weekly. So you could really find your, inspiration everywhere.
Yes. Okay, I have a couple questions.
Okay. Okay.
My question about the book is that in the last chapter you wrote in present tense, but the rest of the book is in past tense.
Oh yeah, I did do that, didn't I? Yeah, I forgot about that. I wanted it to feel the more, without giving away what happens in the last chapter. Yeah. Well, you can ask me when I sign your book. You can whisper it. No, but I like the feeling. Given what was happening in that chapter, the immediacy of the present tense, it felt right to me. It's the sort of the best I could do. Tense gets tricky, and voice. That's why I did in Heart of the Matter, Valerie's voice in the third person, because I think it gets confusing to switch narration. So some of that. Some of that's just decisions you make as a writer that just sort of feel right, and you just have to kind of go with it. So it's a good question. Yeah, this is a higher level question happening here tonight. Go ahead.
First of all, I just want to commend you as a fan. I love engaging with you on social media.
Oh,
so thank
thanks.
You for everything that you do. I actually have a couple questions, but the only one that won't spoil is, how did you decide on the fictional Walker University when all the other sports references are so real places?
Right.
Why did you choose to do that?
I almost continued her answer with that, with that answer, but I felt like I was rambling, so I nipped it in the bud. But first of all, thank you for your compliment about Facebook. That is really me. I love Facebook's the ultimate procrastination device. But I was just in Houston and. now what was her, a girl, her name was Savannah, came up to me and she's like, sometimes I get jealous because you've commented on my friend who got engaged. Her name is Katie. And you've commented on her a couple of times, but I go, Katie Fowler. She's like, what? She's like, how do you? She was like, I convinced my fiance it probably wasn't you. I go, no, Katie Fowler. I know her. Gorgeous ring. So I do pay attention on Facebook, which it's fun. But the Walker, that's another little just technical issue that comes along when you're writing and you just have to make an executive decision as a writer. I feel that when you can't change places, well, first of all, when you're adding just little flavor in, like this bakery or that place or this clothing store, I think it's fine to put real places in because it just adds color and lends credibility to your geographical choice. So there's that. When it's completely disruptive, like in Love the One You're With, when there's a photo shoot with a famous person, I had Bono at first, and it was distracting because all you're thinking about is Bono. So then I changed it to a fictional character. But when you can't change it, when it becomes distracting to change it, I leave it. Like the Dallas Cowboys. If I had another professional team in the state of Texas and then another fictional stadium, I feel like that's distracting. And the Cowboys weren't in it enough to matter. So it was worth just leaving. But then you don't want to put Tony Romo in because you can't, because it's a character in the book. So I left the Cowboys but switched the quarterback to a fictional quarterback. Now, when it came to Walker, I just didn't want to be beholden to conferences and schedules and what happened. And this is supposed to be the 2013-14 season. You know, I didn't want to be sort of beholden to all of that. So I had a fictional college. And also, when you throw in an NCAA investigation, you don't want to do that to SMU. I actually did research at SMU. I spent time with the team. Went down to Dallas several times. I have to go do book research. I have to go drink more margaritas and go to football practice. It's really hard to be a writer. That's one of the times it is fun, but it usually is kind of... So Walker, I made fictional because I thought it was easier and less distracting, and the Cowboys I kept as real, and you just sort of make those decisions. And the bottom line is, and the beauty of writing fiction is you can do what you want. You know, you really can make those rules yourself, and sometimes it's just a question of deciding and sticking with it and then continuing with your story. So that's a very good question. Sure.
What advice would you give a beginning writer?
Oh, okay, that's a good question. Well, I'll answer it, and not to dismiss you, but I do have, for those looking for more advice, I do have under my FAQ section, I have a whole lot of advice. But for purposes of tonight, I would say, you know, write what you feel, right? Have a connection to what you're writing. If your goal is to be published and you're trying to be strategic about it, it's probably not going to work. Like if I had tried to write a legal thriller, it's funny, right? It wasn't that thrilling. It really wasn't. But, one more. Okay. So, you have to feel that connection to your characters and just write all the time. I mean, we talked earlier about, I think there are writers out there who just feel this great passion and flow and joy when they write, but I think for the most part it's work. And even though you love it, it still is work. And I liken it to going to the gym or running. I mean, I hate running, but there are people out there who run, who train for a marathon. That can't be the easiest thing in the world to do, but they just do it because it's important to them to run the 26 miles. And I think that's how you have to approach writing a novel or writing a project. It's not always going to be fun, but it's a war of attrition. Have a connection to your characters and write what's inside you. Tell the story that you want to tell. So, yeah, sure. Oh, that's a good question. First line or the last line? I know I keep saying that's a good question, but I've been asked the same questions. This is like week four, and you all are fresh. Nashville's like original. The first line, my problem with the first chapter, the first line, the first paragraph, the first chapter is I'm a perfectionist. So I can't go on the second chapter until I feel like the first chapter is good enough to show my editor, which sometimes can take 3 months, which is way disproportionate to the rest of the journey. So that's probably harder, but I feel like the last line is more pressure because it has to satisfy you all. So that feels like you have to get that right more than you have to get the first right. So we'll do one more question, and then I'll sign you. I got the signal back there, so I'm not trying to cut you off. You can ask me when you come up to the table. But okay, these two, this one and this one. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
How do you come up with the names?
I'm terrible at the names, terrible at the titles. Oh, for their baby names. Oh, I rock at that. That's like my specialty. I thought you meant the titles. I love naming. If anyone's pregnant, I'll help you with your baby names. Please pay attention to your surname when you're choosing. And remember that once you go off and name a child one thing, you're stuck with sort of that theme. You're not stuck with it, but you can't. You know, I had Edward and George, so I couldn't just all of a sudden go off it with Ruby. I mean, I had to stick with Edward, George, Harriet. You have a theme going. It's important. Work with your surname. Pay attention to that. Okay, anyway, someone's pregnant here. I'll help you. So I use baby name books for that. I did, Shay was the first time I've changed a baby's name, a character's name, because I have a slight stutter, and I went to give a speech to my publisher and couldn't say Drew. I mean, I could say it, but it was an issue. And so I changed it to Shay, which is the same feel, right? One syllable, sort of gender neutral, Shea Stadium. I kind of like that tie-in, so... Anyway, that's a good question, and I'm good at naming my characters. And that'll be our last question.
Do you always know the outcome to your books whenever you start writing it? And if you do, have you ever changed it in the middle based on how it's going?
I don't know my outcome. I do have the premise and the characters, as I talked about before, and the characters drive the plot. So I have a general sense of beginning, middle, and end when I write, but... very frequently that changes. It's something borrowed, I didn't intend. If you haven't read that or seen the movie, tough. It's been out for years. But, you know, I did not intend for Rachel and Dex to be together because originally I didn't like Dex at first because he was doing what he was doing. So definitionally, you're not going to like him. And Rachel was doing what she was doing, so I wanted them to be sort of punished and not together, and I wanted her to go off on her own and just, you know... But as I wrote that story, I got to like Dex. I thought their relationship was more genuine, you know, because not every couple that starts that way is destined and doomed for failure. Some of them actually are in love and are meant to be together. So that's a perfect example of being true to the characters I created rather than true to my vision or the statement I wanted to make. Eleanor Lippman, who's one of my favorite authors, once said that when asked about her happy endings, she said something more or less about she doesn't want to leave her characters standing on the edge of an abyss for the sake of literary coolness. And it's hard to top Eleanor Lippman's words, so I will end on that note. Thank you so much.